Welcome to another edition of the 51%, Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein. Wrap your head around this. It's July 5th, 1984. You're 19 years old, a runway model, on your way to the airport for a flight to Japan for your first international modeling gig, when out of nowhere, you're hit by a drunk driver. And in the matter of one horrific moment, your life changes forever. Well, that's precisely what happened to Canadian Wendy Crawford, who's been a quadriplegic ever since. As she struggled to identify and come to terms with her new normal, Wendy saw the need to develop a way to raise awareness of and become an advocate for women who face physical challenges. So, in 2002, she founded MobileWomen.org, an online magazine that provides information and a community for women in wheelchairs, allowing them to share and to learn from one another. That's not all. She co-founded Discovery Through Design, an event that raised money for programs for disabled women and for spinal cord injury research. For several years, Wendy also served as chair of Women Without Limits, an offshoot of the United Spinal Association, whose mission is to enhance the lives of women with spinal cord injuries. In 2006, Wendy participated in Uncensored Life, Raw Beauty, an innovative visual arts project designed to transform stereotypes, create new perceptions, and challenge personal obstacles by expanding awareness of women with physical challenges. In 2012, the Buonaconte Fund to Cure Paralysis named Wendy one of their Women of Style and Substance. Wendy, welcome, and I'm really looking forward to our conversation today.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm looking forward to it, too.
Wendy, was modeling your dream?
To be honest, not really. I did want to see the world, and that was a vehicle in order to do that. But it was not something I ever thought of doing. It just kind of came about. And, you know, when I knew that I could start traveling, I was really excited. And I always loved fashion, so I enjoyed that from as an art.
Well, clearly you had the props to become a model. So did somebody sort of come up to you and say, wow, you're really beautiful, you should be a model?
No. Actually, I was a tomboy, and I had buck teeth, and...
You're giving hope to all the other people who have had orthodonture, huh?
Yeah, I was skinny and, you know, lanky. I was such a tomboy, and I really didn't have much confidence at all, and it wasn't until... I was asked by my hairdresser one time if I would fill in for someone who at some modeling thing that he was doing, some hair competition. And so I did that, and I took some classes actually to gain some self-esteem and learn how to put on makeup, and because I figured I was going into the working world, I better start looking like a girl. And gradually that's how it happened, but it wasn't something that I planned ahead, and it took me a long time to get my confidence.
But what's so interesting is that 6 months into your profession, you get this overseas assignment. Is that typical, not typical?
You know, I don't know. I only know my story, but I think some people can take off and other people can really try. And, you know, I was just fortunate to be around some really good talent and the right people. And I really pushed my agent to find work for me out of the country because that was, you know, like my goal. I wanted to travel, so... So that's how it all came about. And at that time, a lot of people were modeling in Japan. It was kind of the big thing at that time.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. And then after that, I was supposed to model for Ford's in New York, but they wanted me to get some experience because I was a little smaller than some of the models at that time.
So you're 6 months into the profession. You're going to Japan. You're on your way to the airport. So talk to me about that fateful trip.
Well, I got a ride with a friend, and I had moved all my stuff from my apartment, and I lived in Cambridge, Ontario, which is about an hour from Toronto. At least that's where I grew up. So we went back to Cambridge. I saw my family, and then my friend came to pick me up and take me to the airport, and he was late, and we left, and it was a really hot summer day. So once we got onto the highway, it was really foggy, and we didn't realize that until we got on the highway. And so we decided to exit as soon as we got on, you know, just look for the first exit. And we finally saw it, and my friend was, you know, driving slow looking for the exit. And as we got onto the exit, I instinctively looked behind us because I remember my father saying when I learned how to drive, don't go slow in the fog. And so I looked behind us, and right when I looked, I saw these headlights right there. And the car hit us. You know, I heard this horrific smash. And I just fell forward. And the car spun out, and we went from the exit lane. We spun across three or four lanes of traffic and was stuck in the fast lane. And I came to when the vehicle stopped, and I was slumped forward, and I had a seatbelt across my chest holding me up. And I couldn't lift up my head. And I used to be a swimming instructor and a lifeguard, so I knew a little bit about spinal cord injuries. And I looked at my legs and my hands, and I knew I couldn't feel them. And I knew that I had a spinal cord injury.
Just in a matter of seconds, you diagnosed yourself.
Right. And so I could smell gas leaking into the car. So my friend was just kind of sitting there stunned. And I said, you know, are you okay? And he said, yeah. And I said, you need to get out of the vehicle. And he got out of the vehicle, and I was just stuck there. And that was the worst feeling, because I could hear cars trying not to hit us in the fog. So I could hear them hitting the brakes, squealing around the car. And that was the most terrifying moment of my life, because I was so afraid I was going to get hit again. And finally, you know, some people stopped, and one of the guys was an ambulance driver off duty. So he came, and he realized I broke my neck. And so he said he was going to stabilize my neck. And I asked him how he was going to do it, because I knew that was what you should do, make sure. So he told me, and I said, okay. So he stabilized my neck. And then we waited for the police, and we were still stuck. I was still stuck out there because of the gas was leaking. So they needed the fire department to come, but we were kind of between towns. So we had to wait for this volunteer fire department to come before they would open the door in case, you know, it went on fire. So
how long were you in the car?
You know, I don't even know. It seems like forever, but gradually I kind of started to feel like I was going to fall asleep. And I thought, you can't fall asleep, because that could be dying. So
here you are talking to you, that you have the presence of mind to remain calm and not hysterical.
I did. That was the crazy thing. And I remember when the ambulance drivers finally came, I recognized the voice and realized it was my supervisor from when I was working at the pool, and he taught me a lot of my first aid courses. And so I said, you know, Craig, it's me. And he said, who? And I said, it's Wendy. And he didn't recognize me. I was slumped forward, and he couldn't really see my face. And I said to him that time, I said, am I going to be able to walk again? And he said, I can't answer that question. So it was, you know, it was really strange. But then once they lifted me out of the car, it was excruciating pain. And then once I got in the ambulance, I started to go in and out just from the pain. So I don't remember a lot after that.
The driver, your friend, was not injured?
No, I think, you know, he pulled his back a little and stuff, but he was fine. They think what happened to me, because my vertebrae weren't broken, they were shattered, that my suitcase from the back seat flew over and hit me in the back of the neck.
Oh, God. Really?
Yes. So every time now I get in a car, I drive my husband crazy, because I'm like, you can't put that there. You need to put that there.
Whoever would have thought that? I mean, wow. Or else you travel really light, like with the clothes on your back, right?
Well, I think, too, because I turned to look, maybe my head wasn't in line with the headrest the way it should have been.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So they extricate you from the car, and the next thing you know, you wake up in the ICU.
Yeah, I we transferred me to one hospital, and I remember my brother came, and he asked if he should pray for me. And it's funny, because I didn't really attend church that much as a kid. But at that moment, I said, yes, please pray for me. And they had to transfer me to a different hospital to do the surgery, which was an hour away. And then they did a surgery to they took a piece of bone from my hip and fused it into my neck. And then put a metal halo on, which is this metal ring that goes around your skull. They screw it into four places into the bone, and it attaches to a vest, so your neck is immobilized for 3 months usually. And they also did a tracheotomy because at that point I couldn't breathe. Because your lungs are paralyzed, so you're breathing with your diaphragm, but initially you can't do that.
So here you are completely immobilized, and what's going on from the neck up, as in your head?
Well, for a while, not much, because I think I was on a lot of medication.
Yeah.
My mother said the first question I asked was, can I have children, which I don't remember asking.
Mm.
And then it was just, basically it was just survival for a long time. I was in so much pain, and the not being able to breathe properly, really, I didn't do well with that. You know, they would have to calm me down, because I would be on medication and I would think I just wanted to get out of the bed. And I mm-hmm. thought the nurses were holding me down.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't comprehending. I was paralyzed. So, you know, that went on for a long time. And then it was just gradually each step, what's next, like getting rid of this apparatus, getting rid of the tracheotomy, getting, you know, just gradually getting back to health. And I lost quite a bit of weight because I wasn't allowed to eat at first. And so, you know, it was kind of getting my strength back. And I was in the hospital for almost a year. Yeah.
And undergoing rehab at that time too?
Yeah, at that time it was more common. Now they don't keep people in as long. But at that time, they really want to educate you on how to take care of yourself. And so I was in the hospital in rehabilitation with people that had spinal cord injuries, that had had strokes, that had brain injuries. And that was quite the reality check for me, because I'd always been so healthy and athletic. And I never had been in the hospital before. I never really had family members, you know, that had been sick. So it was a whole new world to me.
Mm.
And I couldn't imagine having a normal life again.
If you're just joining me, my guest today is Wendy Crawford, who back on July 5th of 1984, on her way to the airport to go to Japan for a modeling gig, was struck by a drunk driver and became a quadriplegic, and has founded mobilewomen.org, an online magazine that provides information and a community for women in wheelchairs. So you're dealing with this horrific new normal. And in a way, it's the double whammy of earning your living from your looks. And now you probably think people are looking at you, obviously, in a different way. What the hell was that like?
Oh, they were definitely looking at me, especially when I had the halo. It was pretty scary. I was allowed to go home weekends eventually. So, you know, I felt like everyone was staring at me, and not in a good way.
Of course.
But, I mean, people still do stare, but I try to think of it as they're just curious, and I'm not offended by it, not usually.
You don't feel patronized by it?
It can be annoying when people won't stop. You know, they'll stare, you know, it's one thing to glance, but when they keep it up. But,
mm-hmm.
And I mean, I've done the same thing. You know, you look at someone who maybe is different. And I think also people stare when you're young. I mean, that was 30 years ago. I'm not as young, but when you're young and you look healthy, it's like, why is that person in a wheelchair?
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's just ignorance more than anything. And that's why I work so hard on these different projects to transform stereotypes and to educate the public.
Well, did you feel back then, if not only today as well, dismissed?
I did, especially in the fashion industry, because at that point I just wanted to get better and get back to my life. And I think I was a little in denial and thought, if I could just get my life back to the way it was in the same routine, then everything would be okay. And so, you know, I talked to my agent and she tried to get me work, but
you knew that
wasn't for me.
You knew that wasn't going to happen, didn't you?
I don't think I did. I think in my mind, I thought, well, I look the same. Most of my work actually wasn't on the runway. It was more
photography
shots. Yeah. Print mm-hmm. ads. So I thought, well, you know, my face is the same. And I don't know, I guess at first I was naive and thought maybe I could do this, but
did you think the fashion industry would be that enlightened, Wendy, for heaven's sake?
I was 19, I guess. I thought I don't know. I just wanted my life back. You know, mm-hmm. I wasn't
sure.
And the thing is, 30 years later, it isn't that much. I mean, I think it has improved, but I feel like we still have a long way to go.
Well, I would assume that you had to wind up questioning the very notion of beauty.
I didn't even think of it in that big of a scope at that time. I just thought, I just lost a lot of self-esteem. Mm-hmm. You know, I lost my boyfriend at the time. I lost, I just felt like I wasn't that confident to begin with, even though I was modeling.
Sure.
I always felt as though I didn't really belong. You know, I'd been a tomboy my whole life. I was, you know, teased and called a boy when I was little. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. so, you know, I had short hair and they would say, oh, you're in the wrong bathroom, honey. So I wasn't that confident. And I was always like, why am I even here? I don't know if I fit in. You know, you see these beautiful women, I would compare myself.
Sure.
And it has been a really long journey to gain confidence, and then I started questioning the concept of beauty, and the more I grow, the more I understand it better.
You know, I read that Canada's Attorney General hired you to be a spokesperson to warn about the combination of drinking and driving. Did you want that job? Did you want that title?
It's funny you say that, because most people assume I did. I mean, I did. I wanted to work, and I was honored to be asked, but at 19 years old, you just want to be with your friends. You just want to have fun. You just want your life.
Of course. Of course.
And but I did enjoy it once I started, and it really saved my life, because it helped me have a purpose, and that is the one thing that I've needed to do since my accident is I need a purpose.
You need a reason to get up in the morning?
I do. Mm-hmm. I can't just, because people are helping me all day, 24 hours a day. And if I can't contribute somehow, then to me that's difficult. And I think then I start thinking about things and then I feel depressed. Mm-hmm. Where if I'm doing something that can help other people, then I feel good about myself. And that's what I need. And so I really enjoyed working with the students. I worked, I spoke in some institutions, some prisons, and I enjoyed that. But after a while, I did it for a good 5 years. And after a while, I was just sick of my story. Like, I wanted to do something different.
I also read a quote from you that it was a tragedy that the media ate up, the tragedy of your accident. And they would do the same today, sadly, positioning you as the tragic, pretty blonde whose life has been utterly ruined. People eat this stuff up. It makes them feel better about their lives, even if they won't admit it. Boy, I think that's got to be so true.
Like I said, I wanted to model, and the magazines that I had worked for were kind and said, well, we'll do a story about your tragedy, but they didn't want to give me work.
Exactly, and then don't call us.
Yeah, that was basically it.
Well, I'm the same beautiful young woman I was on July 4th that I am after July 5th, and nobody could see that.
Right, and I don't think I even saw it. And
but you just said you wanted your life back.
I did want my life back, but I didn't think of myself as beautiful from the beginning.
That's true. You did say that. Yes.
Yeah, so it took a long time.
So you're trying to find your place in this world, and you come up with this concept of mobilewomen.org. I'd like to hear all about the genesis of this.
I always say that I didn't want to be one of those people with disabilities. And to be honest, I was almost embarrassed. Like, I wanted to be around my friends, but people would say, oh, you know, you have to meet this person in a wheelchair and you can talk to them. And I'm thinking, I don't want to be one of these people.
You didn't want to be
defined
by that.
And I was in denial, and it wasn't until a friend of mine asked me, would I participate in this research study at the Miami Project to Cure Paralysis down in Miami, and I said, okay, because I was living in Toronto, and it was winter.
Let me get the hell out of here.
Right. I'll do that. Uh-huh. And so I started volunteering as a research subject. Well, I was surrounded by other people with spinal cord injuries, and I became friends and gradually started to learn from them. and especially the woman, and we would share experiences. And I would see these women, and they were amazing. Like, they had these tremendous challenges, yet they were able to overcome them and, you know, do all these great things. They were mothers or athletes or, you know, professionals, and I learned from them. And that's when I started to think, you know, and also I was having a hard time finding information at the same time. So I thought, these women are so amazing. Like, the people, the world needs to learn about these women. But also I was having a hard time finding information.
Do you not find that stunning in 2002 that you had to be the proactive one to provide that information? Doesn't that, when you look back, kind of blow your mind? Seriously, there's nothing out there for me? I mean, you're not the first person to wind up in a wheelchair, you know?
It does, and I'm fairly connected with a lot of the big centers. But the thing with spinal cord injuries is 80%, at least that was the percentage, I don't know what it is lately, but 80% are male. So 20% is female, so it's a minority. And it's just not something they spent a lot of time on. So my first encounter is when I was 21. I started dating someone, and I asked my doctor about birth control, and he said to me, "Well, why don't you just get a hysterectomy?" And I was looking at him saying, "Well, I'm only 21. I don't want a hysterectomy. And I might want to have children." And he kind of looked at me like I was crazy.
And
things like getting mammograms or gynecological appointments, any of that stuff, was really difficult in finding places that were accessible. And I started to realize the need for that and for women to be able to get the information a lot easier. And it was just the whole attitude back then. I had a financial advisor one time say to me that I should, I said I wanted to put money aside for when I was in my 30s so that if I had children, I, you know, could afford a nanny. Uh-huh. And he told me to take that money and put it towards a psychologist or a therapist, because why would someone like me want to have a child? Right. And that's what infuriated me, and thought, there's so much ignorance out there, you know, just because maybe I can't bathe my child or something like that doesn't mean I can't be there.
You become persona non grata. You're totally invisible.
Right, right. And I think that actually provided fuel for me and, you know,
so
motivation.
It lights this fire under your behind, and right. You say, I'm going to do something about this. And that in and of itself must have been really seismic, because you said, I just want to get back to my normal life. You never really started anything. You never founded anything. And here you are becoming this mover and shaker in a very different way than what you're used to.
Yeah. I mean, I think sometimes accidents like that bring out either the worst or the
or
better
the best,
in you.
Yes. Or a great catalyst.
Yeah. It just depends on your personality. But for me, you know, I just wanted to start this website, and a friend of mine was able to help me secure a grant. And so we got a grant. I partnered with the Spinal Cord Injury Project at Rutgers Foundation and used their 501c3 in order to get the grant. And we got it set up, and, you know, then we just started running it. And for a while, I had some issues with my arms. They were really getting sore from typing. And it lulled for a while, and then I got kind of a second wind and separated to go on my own, and managed to find other women that believed in what the website was about and volunteered to help. And now we have, I don't even know how many women volunteering to write articles and help me manage the website. So it's basically run all by women with disabilities.
It's wonderful. And so this is your full-time job?
Well, I don't make any money.
Well, hello.
But I work full-time.
Your raison d'etre.
Mm-hmm. But it's important to me. And every time I think, oh, I don't know if I want to do this anymore, then I get an email from someone saying how it changed their lives.
Talk to me also about this Raw Beauty Project.
The Raw Beauty Project originally started down in Miami. And a woman by the name of Shelley Baer and Vanessa Silberman had talked about, Shelley has a disability, and she wanted to do something like a calendar, perhaps, of women with disabilities. And originally they thought of a nude calendar, and they called me and I said, no, I'm not going to be. And I didn't hear from them again. And then finally they called again and said, would you be interested in being in a photography exhibit? So I actually came on board once it had already started. And so I was a model in that. And I came on the committee and helped the latter half of the project. And the mission is to transform stereotypes of women with disabilities and to change perceptions, and then also to inspire others to be able to overcome obstacles.
Mm-hmm.
And so the event was a huge success, and we got a lot of press down in Miami, local press, and people were blown away by it. They saw a woman in a different light. I never forget, this friend of mine came up to me and he said, I never thought of women as being disabled women as being sexual. And the photos were based on three words, empowerment, beauty, and sensuality. So, you know, some people did kind of sexy shots, and we all did something different. And I just looked at him, I thought, really? Like, you know, I knew he wasn't a jerk because he was my friend.
I don't have friends who are jerks, right?
I thought, oh my God, this is how people think. You know, I just don't think this way because I've been around it, but the general population probably just doesn't know. So that was shocking to me. And we wanted to do it again, but everyone was busy doing their own thing. You know, I had the website and everybody else had jobs and things. And so finally I said, I really want to do this in New York. I think it could be amazing in New York. I thought of the Christopher Reeve Foundation because I was partnering with them with my website, the Christopher and Dana Reeve Foundation. So I talked to them, and they were interested in us partnering with them because we're not really an entity. We could use their 501c3 and raise money for them. And they do fund a lot of quality of life projects that involve women. And they wanted to do more outreach to women because, once again, they had been doing a lot for males, you know, and wanted to do more for women. So it worked out really well, and we just had it, and it was a really huge success, I think. It was great. We got 20 women with disabilities, various disabilities. We had about 17 photographers. I pulled in some of the photographers I modeled with 30 years ago.
Wow.
And they were so supportive. We had journalists. We had a couple students because we thought it was important to have some students because we want to inspire the photographers later on down the road when they need a model.
Sure.
You know, to think in terms of women with disabilities. And it wasn't about necessarily picking people that were the most traditionally pretty. We want to pick women that were able to overcome the obstacles, that were able to thrive and be able to contribute to others. That was really important to us.
Well, unfortunately, we've run out of time. I could talk to you forever. You're a hell of a lady, Wendy.
Oh, thank you very much. Well, there's lots of amazing ladies out there that I hope that people will take the time to see the beauty in all of us. And it's not just about women in wheelchairs. It's about all women and the fact that we all are beautiful. And beauty is in strength and uniqueness and confidence. And that's, to me, that's what's important, and that's the message I'd like to get out, because, you know, we deserve to be part of being beautiful, too, and recognized as that.
Well, and also, we're the 51%, so that's that. Thanks again, Wendy.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Join us for another edition of the 51%, Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein.
Thanks for listening to the 51%, Conversations with Creative Women. For show comments and suggestions, please follow us on Twitter at Sandy Klein Show. You can also find us on Facebook at The 51% Conversations. The show is produced and recorded by Chad Dugatz at the Hangar Studios in New York City. Sandy Klein is our executive producer.